condition that all airspace surrounding Venezuela is closed. Trump said the U.S. is poised to launch attacks inside Venezuela itself because he says the president of Venezuela is a drug trafficker. And here he says he's going to pardon a leading drug trafficker, someone convicted of drug trafficking. By the way, that's in addition to his brother, Tony Hernandez, who's serving a life sentence here for drug trafficking. Can you talk about the significance of this moment?
Well, you know, obviously this contradiction between Trump's criminal acts attacking people of Venezuela, Colombia, and other parts of and Ecuador in the name of fighting drug trafficking, and that, you know, that is a front for other regime change in Venezuela and wanting Venezuelan oil. So all of this is about his rhetoric and really dangerous military acts against Venezuela in the name of fighting drug trafficking, and at the same time he pardons one of the, you know, this famous drug trafficker. And, you know, I want to underscore that the evidence from the Southern District of New York was overwhelming. Juan Hernandez has been sentenced to 45 years in U.S. federal prison. But one of the things that's missing here is that this is not just contradiction in terms of drug war. It's an outrageous subversion of rule of law in the United States. For the president to just, you know, tweet out or send out in social media that he's going to pardon a major former president of another country convicted of drug trafficking and other crimes, and just throw the Justice Department conviction of Juan Orlando and all their years and years of many people working on this case impeccably, and to just throw that out the window is also terrifying for the people of the United States. So what he's doing is a threat to democracy in Honduras, outrageously, but also in the United States. And of course, we're used to saying it's outrageous, but here he is showing overt sympathy to a criminal and saying, well, he's obviously bonding with a criminal, another president who's a criminal, supporting Asfura, who worked closely with Juan Orlando. And, you know, Asfura, the candidate that Trump supports, you know, worked has himself been charged with stealing a huge amount of public money that was destined for a light rail system in Tegucigalpa. And Nasrallah, the other right-wing candidate, you know, supports, like Asfura, Bukele and Milei and Trump, you know, it's this authoritarian right project that Trump is supporting at the point of a gun here. You know, this is a really terrifying act of intervention into as Rudo pointed out, into another country. It's not news, but it's to so boldly intervene in an election. It's like blackmail. If you don't support Asfura, we're going. Who knows? The gunboats could be out there attacking Honduras if Rixey wins. And I think people know that in Honduras. And you want to remember about the question of the immigrants in here, because a third or a quarter of the Honduran economy runs on remittances. And Trump is already attacking Honduran immigrants in really dangerous and terrifying ways and deportations.
Dana Frank.
So, you know, I think we want to be alarmed about all this.
What surprised you most? I mean, you've covered Honduras for decades. You've taught about it. You've written about it. When you sat in that trial, the extent of Juan Orlando Hernandez's involvement with drug trafficking, with cocaine to the United States, the man who Trump says he's about to pardon.
Well, you know, it was breathtaking, and the evidence was not just about Juan Orlando, about his minister of security that the U.S. worked with for many years, about his right-hand man, Ebal Diaz, on and on, all sorts of people in his regime and in his party with which Asfura, the national party candidate, is affiliated. And, you know, the other thing in this that, you know, I think people may not be aware is, you know, not only did Obama and Trump and Biden all support Juan Orlando and look the other way at his many crimes, but his crimes, as Rulo underscored, are not just about drug trafficking. He supported the coup when he was on the congressional committee. He led the so-called technical coup that overthrew the Supreme Court in 2012 when he was president of Congress. He turned the military and the troops on peaceful protesters in 2017 when he ran completely illegally for re-election. But, you know, I think something people are not aware of is also that the Biden administration and the Trump did not want Trump to be, did not want Hernandez to be extradited. You know, 2 weeks after Chamorro was inaugurated and Juan Orlando was out of office, Biden administration finally allowed Juan Orlando Hernandez to be extradited to the United States. But the Southern District of New York had been working on that for 5 years. And in the year before had been trying to indict Juan Orlando, and Biden would not allow it. So there's this long history of U.S. military support for Juan Orlando and for his regime and for his many crimes. And so it's not like even Biden acted heroically. This is a long history of the U.S. supporting Juan Orlando. And Trump is just one more link in that chain. It is shocking if you saw the amount of evidence in that trial and how impeccable those prosecutors are. It was extremely impressive to watch their work and how careful they are. And to see that thrown out, you feel that in your gut about what happened to the rule of law in the United States in this, as well as the subversion of the rule of law in Honduras. And why was Juan Orlando not prosecuted in Honduras? Because the U.S. supported the coup and the post-coup regimes, which destroyed the rule of law and on many fronts. And that's why the gangs moved into that gap. And that's why there's so much mass poverty and why people have had to flee to the United States.
In addition to historian Dana Frank, we're joined by Spencer Ackerman, the Pulitzer Prize and National Magazine Award-winning reporter, author of Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump, and author of the Forever Wars newsletter. You wrote a very interesting piece, Spencer, The Legacy of the War on Terror Reaches South America. As we talk to Rodolfo Pastor and Dana Frank, can you talk about this moment where President Trump has said he's going to pardon a major convicted drug trafficker who is supposed to spend the rest of his life in jail, and the bombing of supposed drug boats in the Caribbean and Pacific and the closing of the airspace over Venezuela, saying he's about to attack it for drug trafficking, he claims.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Amy. I think we're at a really dangerous point in American history right now. Naturally, I don't need to tell you or your guests the legacy of the American dirty wars in Latin America of the 1980s on the war on terror. But now we've got the war on terror reflected in the way that the Trump administration is targeting Venezuela, Ecuador, Honduras. I'm sorry, Venezuela, Colombia, Honduras, and beyond. We learned over the weekend that the initial strike on these fishermen boats back in September was a double tap strike ordered by the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth himself, and executed with the full approval of the, at the time, Joint Special Operations Command Commander Admiral Mitch Bradley, who's now the commander of U.S. Special Operations Command. This was beyond even many of the illegal actions taken of the war on terror. However, this shows the moral degeneracy that the war on terror has left as a legacy in the U.S. military, not just the tactic of a drone strike, but the willingness to kill civilians. The double tap strike, the strike means that that's a second strike on a target already struck to ensure no survivors. If those were, in fact, people with whom the United States is at war with, as the Trump administration claims, then the second strike is a blatant violation of the law of armed conflict. You are supposed to leave survivors and not give no quarter. If we are not, in fact, at war, as for other purposes, the Trump administration's Office of Legal Counsel says, when it's trying to avoid congressional authorization of these sorts of strikes, then this is simply like every other strike that has killed now over 80 people, simply a criminal act of murder.
I mean, you have now Republican-led committees in both the House and the Senate saying they're going to hold oversight hearings to investigate the Pentagon's attacks on the boats, particularly that one September 2nd, where two men survived, were hanging onto the boat, and they struck it again. You have President Trump trying to defend Hegseth, who sources say was the one who ordered the second strike. And what did he do last night? That's Secretary of Defense Hegseth. He tweeted out or put on social media a meme of the children's cartoon character Franklin the Turtle opening fire from a helicopter on boats below. Both the House and Senate, Republicans and Democrats like Senators Reid and Wicker, calling for an investigation into war crimes here. And this goes together with the senators and the senator and Senator Kelly in Arizona and the other Congress members, former military and intelligence, saying, do not follow illegal orders. It doesn't matter if you were ordered from a superior. You will not be protected if you engage in war crimes.
This is a make-or-break moment for American democracy. We need Hegseth impeached. We need Bradley impeached. Obviously, there's a separate question about Trump, who's ultimately responsible for this. But these men must not be permitted to remain in their jobs. They are turning the military into a criminal operation. We can have a great historical debate about all of the steps necessary to produce that point and previous examples of military commanders following illegal orders. But this is unambiguous. This is as bright line of violation as it gets. This turns the military into something that I think even those Republicans on those committees who have been willing to put up with and have been complicit in so much, as frankly have the Democratic members, this is a step too far. But if there is no accountability for this moment, we should expect it to repeat.
And you also have, at this point, in addition to Republicans and Democrats calling for investigation, the top Pentagon lawyers, the military lawyers who would say to Hegseth this is illegal, he fired them many months ago.
As well as he fired the Joint Chiefs of Staff chairman simply for being black. This is someone who never should have been anywhere close to the office of the Secretary of Defense, one of the most powerful offices in the world. I want to point out a really important forthcoming date. That's December 12th. Reportedly, December 12th is the final day that Admiral Alvin Halsey, the Southcom commander who apparently quit to refuse these criminal orders, is out of his job and out of the military. It's going to be crucial to bring Halsey in front of congressional hearings to talk about exactly what he did ahead of his decision to quit, what Hegseth ordered him to do, what others inside the Secretary of Defense's office ordered him to do that apparently he was not willing to do. This is going to be a crucial moment of investigation if we are to recapture any semblance of lawfulness over the U.S. military.
Spencer Ackerman, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, founder of the Forever Wars newsletter. I want to thank you for being with us and ask you to stay with us because we want to ask you at the end of the show about a piece you just wrote. He killed for the CIA in Afghanistan. Trump blames Afghan culture instead of Langley's. We want to ask you about that. But I also want to thank Dana Frank for joining us, professor of history emerita at UC Santa Cruz, speaking to us from California, and Rodolfo Pastor, Honduran politician, former secretary of the presidency under President Xiomara Castro, speaking to us from Honduras. Next up, the Trump administration stopped issuing visas for Afghan nationals after an Afghan man who once worked for the CIA opened fire near the White House, shooting two members of the West Virginia National Guard, killing one. Stay with us.
Muévete, muévete, mueve tu cadera, ve. Muévete, muévete, mueve tus caderas, ve, como si fueras el viento, como si fueras el viento, como si fueras la lluvia, como si no hubiera tiempo. Muévete, muévete, mueve tus caderas, ve, muévete, muévete, mueve tus caderas. Como si fueras el viento, como si fueras el viento, como si fueras la lluvia, como si no hubiera tiempo.
The This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at President Trump's call to pause all asylum decisions after an Afghan man who once worked for the CIA opened fire near the White House last Wednesday, shooting two National Guard members, killing one. Ramanullah Lakhanwal allegedly killed West Virginia National Guard specialist Sarah Beckstrom. She was 20 years old, and critically wounded Andrew Wolf, who was 24. On Thursday, Trump posted on social media, quote, "I will permanently pause migration from all third world countries to allow the U.S. system to fully recover, terminate all the millions of Biden illegal admissions. Only reverse migration can fully cure the situation. Other than that, happy Thanksgiving to all, except those that hate, steal, murder and destroy everything that America stands for. You won't be here for long," Trump wrote. Lakhanwal is charged with first-degree murder, will likely face terrorism charges. He previously worked in a CIA-backed Afghan army unit known as Zero Unit, often called a death squad by human rights groups. He entered the United States in 2021 through Operation Allies Welcome, a program that saw the U.S. evacuate thousands of Afghans who faced reprisals from the Taliban over their support of the U.S. occupation. He applied for asylum in 2024 and was granted refugee status last April under the second Trump administration. Still with us, Spencer Ackerman, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter. We're also joined in Washington, D.C. by Leila Ayoub, the executive director of Project Anar. And in San Diego, California, we're going to start with Sean Van Diver, president and board chair of Afghan Evac. Sean Van Diver, this horror that took place in Washington, the shooting of the two National Guardsmen, one of them now dead. Can you talk about Trump's response?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on this morning. Look, there's just no question this is an absolute tragedy. No family should have to deal with an epidemic of gun violence in our country. And it's awful that we've lost one of these National Guardsmen, Ms. Beckwith, and that that another one is fighting for his life in D.C. President Trump's reaction, though, and Kash Patel's reaction, and Kristi Noem's, and Marco Rubio's, and J.D. Vance, is all over the place. It's off base. They shouldn't be leveraging this absolute tragedy as a political cudgel to do whatever they were going to do anyways with our immigration regarding our wartime allies and other refugees and asylum seekers from around the world. It's an unconscionable tragedy that they would leverage the awful experience, the awful incident that occurred there. And these folks served with us for 20 years. I was on BBC last night and I called them liars, all of them. They're lying about whether or not he was vetted. They're lying about the fact that they approved his entry. This is a case of a tragic breakdown in our mental health system, not a case of messed up vetting or anything other than that.
Explain who the people are who you've been working on to get into this country. you yourself from the military.
Sure. So I didn't serve in Afghanistan. I served all over the world, but not in Afghanistan. As we go around the world and we fight our wars, the U.S. military and our diplomats and other frontline civilians need support from local people who believe in our mission. And in Afghanistan, over our longest war, over the course of 20 years, hundreds of thousands of people stood up for the idea of democracy, believed in our mission, and believed us when we told them, if you stand with us, we'll stand with you. If you work with us, you can come become an American. You can have your shot at the American dream. The Trump administration, the Biden administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, everybody has let these folks down. For the very first time in our country's history, back in 2021, the civil society, stood up with the Biden administration. We dragged them to the right place. We got them to build something called Enduring Welcome, which is the safest, most secure immigration policy in our country's history. And it represents the very first time that our country was actually answering the call for our wartime allies. It was too slow, but it was working. We were getting 5,000 wartime allies and their families out every month from Afghanistan to a third country. They'd undergo even more security vetting and then come to the United States of America and start their American dream in a durable pathway. Before we built Enduring Welcome, Operation Allies Welcome brought about 77,000 Afghans here, but many came on a non-durable status. They came as parolees, or they came as they were awaiting an immigration status like SIV. Many had to apply for asylum once they got here. And it's that population that's been really, everybody's been stuck in limbo, but this population's been stuck in limbo in the United States. And now they're being targeted by President Trump's political stunts at immigration court, and, you know, they're snatching teachers out of classrooms. These folks have done nothing but believe us and believe in the idea of America, and we've really let them down.
I want to bring Leila Ayoub into this conversation, executive director of Project Anar. If you can talk specifically about women who have come to this country, who have left Afghanistan, and your concerns about President Trump halting all evaluations of people applying for political asylum in the United States after the 20-year U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and now the Taliban in charge.
Yes. So this decision to halt or pause all asylum adjudications with USCIS, it is really clearly an extension of this existing agenda that the administration has had towards abandoning the U.S.'s obligations under international and domestic law to offer protection to people. We have been seeing advancements in other countries, particularly for women, for gender-based asylum claims. And earlier this summer, we saw the administration target those kinds of claims. Now we're seeing, earlier last week, we saw a directive to reevaluate all of the refugee admissions from under the Biden administration. Now we're seeing this administration weaponize last week's tragedy to scapegoat and collectively punish an entire community. First, they made announcements about policies targeting Afghans, including restricting and pausing indefinitely the processing of all immigration applications with USCIS. And then we saw a number of statements that really went beyond that and targeted the 19 countries on the travel ban list, as well as these undefined terms like third world countries and broader categories such as people who are not a net asset to the U.S. It's really dehumanizing. It is also illogical and irrational for many reasons, including because refugees and immigrants contribute to this country in so many ways. So this is an extremely concerning effort to punish all Afghans, all immigrants, and people who came here oftentimes as a direct result of U.S. foreign policy and didn't have really much of a choice left other than to flee their homes.
Lakhanwal has a wife and five children. They're based in Bellingham, Washington. This suggestion is that they would be deported. Where to, do you think, Leila?
Well, we're seeing that this administration has been, there's been a pattern of removing people to third world, to third countries, not to that undefined term of third world, but to third countries. And there's also deportations to Afghanistan. So we don't know what their plan is with this particular family. But what we do know is that in order to accomplish these efforts of large-scale targeting of not just that family, which is not something that you know I am particularly aware of, but the Afghan community in general, the immigrant community in general, it requires surveillance and increased militarism, increased policing, and none of these things really keep us safer in our communities here. They just harm more of our neighbors and more of our loved ones.
I want to bring Spencer Ackerman into this conversation. You have a new piece in Zatteo headlined, "He Killed for the CIA in Afghanistan. Trump Blames Afghan Culture Instead of Langley's." Can you elaborate? Sorry, I can't hear you. Start again. Start again.
Yes. Can you hear me, Amy?
Yes.
Yes. Your guests have spoken very eloquently about the betrayal and the dishonor that the collective guilt of Afghan refugees ascribed by the Trump administration for this horrific murder is having. What we're focusing on less is that the person, what we're focusing on less is that the person who committed allegedly these crimes, Lakhanwal, had a gun put in his hand when he was a child by the CIA. Apparently, when he was 14 or 15, he was brought into the zero unit number three around Kandahar. Apparently, his brother told the New York Times, apparently, his brother, the New York Times reported, was a deputy commander of this unit. This unit was a death squad. The United States made this person into a child soldier and now is experiencing what I think is one of the most horrifically bright line cases of imperial blowback that we've seen throughout the war on terror. If the United States wants to find out whose culture is responsible for this horrific crime, it needs to start by knocking on doors at Langley and as well the Afghans who ran the U.S.-backed Afghan intelligence service known as the NDS. It was this culture of violence, of impunity, of murder for political reasons that had a specific role, we'll find out more at trial, of shaping Lakhanwal and his circumstances. To blame the Afghans who came here as refugees, desperate, overwhelmingly, as your guest said, who worked with the United States, who served the U.S. war effort, is perverse, and it is ultimately a cover for allowing the U.S. to continue to create death squads to outsource its most murderous and its most despicable wartime actions to locals who then it can blame them for.
Mm. I was thinking about Timothy McVeigh, who was on the highway of death in Iraq. He comes back from there. He blows up the Oklahoma City building. He kills, what, something like 169 people. No one said then that all white Christian men should be imprisoned, let alone deported. But your thoughts on those kind of comparisons?
I think what we are really seeing is the horrific consequences of a violent, exploitative, and extractive U.S. foreign policy once again, not for the first time, but once again coming home. If the United States actually cherishes the lives of these West Virginia National Guardsmen who should not have been in D.C. in the first place to backstop ICE, that's its own issue. But if the United States values their lives and values the lives of other service members and other Americans, that it has an obligation to, in the first instance, stop creating these death squads, to stop creating the conditions that are warping the people who serve in them to the point where they would commit horrific murders like these. That's a cherishing of human life that we never see from the United States in its foreign policy missions around the world.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll link to your piece, "He Killed for the CIA in Afghanistan, Trump Blames Afghan Culture Instead of Langley's." And we want to thank Sean Van Diver, president of Afghan Evac, and Leila Ayoub, executive director of Project Anar. That does it for our show. I'll be in Sag Harbor on December 4th at the Hamptons Doc Film Festival. Check our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Chef Robert Rainford. Nearly one in three black children in Canada goes hungry while food gets thrown away. The Food Security Fund is changing that. Led by Support Black Charities, the plan is to build a better pathway from community gardens to nutritious meals through local food hubs. This isn't just charity. This is community infrastructure. Join us and build a better future for black families to have consistent, dignified access to good food. Join us at foodsecurityfund.ca. Contribute today. Thank you.
And you know,